Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Our first guest today is New York City Police Commissioner William Bratton. Commissioner, it's been a few quick decades. Welcome back to the city and welcome back to the program.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
So you're on a media blitz, I understand, to counter what you feel are misperceptions people are getting from the Eric Garner case. What's the most important one?
Well, I think that the whole issue around in the event of the death of Mr. Garner, the circumstances leading up to the event, which was the concern about the so-called sale of Lucy's, a quality of life offense, I think the resultant attention, publicity, focused on the quality of life activities of the department and the debate about it, is that type of enforcement effort necessary? And I think there's an awful lot of confusion about quality of life, so-called broken windows types of activity on the part of the police department. So we're making an effort to just clarify it for people and have the public fully understand and appreciate its importance in the overall scheme of crime reduction and fear and disorder reduction in the city.
Well, I saw you acknowledge the other day, and tell me if I got this wrong, that police get involved in small infractions like drinking from an open bottle or selling loose cigarettes. More in high-crime neighborhoods, which tend to be Black and Latino neighborhoods. So your argument is that a racially disparate impact is necessary to protect the people of those neighborhoods?
No, the idea is we go where the concerns are expressed, so that if, in fact, those types of complaints, the vast majority of what we do relative to quality of life is people calling 911, 311. And if you take a look at where a lot of those calls are coming from, they tend to be oftentimes in minority neighborhoods. So it's the community themselves, the law-abiding community, the people that want to be free of some of the disorders, some of the disturbances that are disturbing their lives, loud music parties at 1:30, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. And in certain neighborhoods, the sale of Lucy cigarettes, where store owners, the bodegas who are paying taxes, can't make money because cigarettes are one of their bigger selling items in a lot of those locations. So the idea that, is that activity more frequent in minority neighborhoods, that's not as a result of the actions of the police. It's the result of the actions of the police responding to the calls from those neighborhoods. You also then have the compounding fact that with more police in those neighborhoods, both for responding to 911, 311 calls, as well as, unfortunately, in a number of precincts, about 10 to 15 of our precincts, still have higher violent crime levels than the rest of the city. That's where we put our police. We put our cops on the dots, where the 911 calls are, where the violent crime is occurring. So those communities definitely want more police in their neighborhoods. As more police are in those neighborhoods, they are going to encounter more things in their patrol that we expect them to take action on.
It's interesting.
So there's a duality of things going on.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting what you said about Lucy's being a problem more in some neighborhoods than others. George Kelling, who you know, the creator of the broken windows policing theory, said in yesterday's New York Times basically the same thing, that loose cigarette sales would draw a broken windows police response only if they were seen as a crime that was affecting the quality of life in a systemic way in a given neighborhood. So if that's how it's done, is this where selective enforcement meets common sense?
Well, the reality of policing is the selective enforcement is oftentimes response to what neighborhoods, what residents of those neighborhoods, what political leaders of those neighborhoods want us to focus on, because that's what's disturbing the quality of life in their neighborhoods.
And was that, in that case, in that Staten Island neighborhood, on that list?
Certainly was. That in terms of the issue as it relates to Mr. Garner, the public information about his previous encounters with the police were around that issue. So that effectively police is often drawn to certain conditions in neighborhoods, not so much of because of a priority on our part, but a response to the concerns of the neighborhood, whether it's business people, political leaders, residents, as to what they want addressed in their neighborhood. I had a meeting up in my office several weeks after the death of Mr. Garner with a group of concerned city council members that come from neighborhoods with very high crime levels, unfortunately, who are expressing concern about tensions between police and their constituents. To a person in that discussion that evolved around many issues, a concern that they were seeking assistance with in their neighborhoods had to do with loud parties, barbecues, things that went on in their neighborhoods that their constituents were complaining about. So there's a case in point where we are being drawn into the neighborhood at the request of the political leadership of that neighborhood and the concerns of their constituents being voiced to them.
Our guest is Police Commissioner Bratton on WNYC. The pushback, though, is that whether it's stop and frisk, Ray Kelly style, or broken windows, your style, it still amounts to constant contact between poor people of color and the police for small things. Well, different from another neighborhood, with the effect of many kids getting criminal records and the rare but occasional tragedy like Eric Garner.
There were two distinct differences between stop, question, and frisk, and quality of life offenses. One is a reasonable suspicion, and I think it was clearly understood by both the federal court decision, the reaction of many of the political leaders of the city, and indeed myself, in terms of, as I commented on it, that and the union leadership of the rank and file of the NYPD, the belief that their officers were being pushed to get too many stop, question, and frisk levels of activity. And we have dropped that level down dramatically and with no significant resultant increase in crime, with one single exception, and that's in the areas of shootings. Other than that, crime is down in every other category that we measure. In terms of quality of life types of offenses, those are, in fact, actual criminal acts witnessed by a police officer or violations of city ordinances, whether it's traffic offenses, littering. All these things are, in fact, against the law, if you will. That's what police are expected to do, is enforce the law. And if people would obey the law, then they would not be drawing the attention of the police.
And I hear what you're saying, and I've heard you say this before, and I think it's an important point, that a difference between stop and frisk, as it was, and broken windows, your style, is that more of the people your department stops get arrested because they're actually doing something. But we still have this community outcry again. So is it an unsolvable problem because whatever you do that actually prevents crime rather than just arrest perpetrators after the fact will feel to many people like keeping your boot on poor people of color?
No, not at all. That we are in this city, for example, that we're showing significant decreases in summons activity in marijuana arrests, for example. No, the department is always engaged in trying to provide balance. The idea being that a significant part of what we do is in response to citizens. If we were to stop responding to 911 emergency calls or 311 quality of life calls, there would be a phenomenal hue and cry that we were neglecting the minorities of the city because, unfortunately, for many minorities, the neighborhoods they live in, some of the circumstances they find themselves encumbered with, that there are in their neighborhoods, unfortunately, a higher proportion of people who commit crime than in other areas of the city, that they want something done about that. The challenge for police, and this goes to the heart of the recent mayoral election, Mayor de Blasio's campaign, challenge for him as mayor, the challenge now for me as police commissioner, is to ensure that in our supervision of our officers, in our training of them, in our guidance of them, that they're always reminded of the need to police constitutionally, that you can't break the law to enforce it. And secondly, that to the greatest degree possible, try to do it in a way that we build relationships rather than worsen them.
So since you're emphasizing 911 calls, 311 calls, do you think preventive policing, a la broken windows, is a trade-off that most Black and Latino residents of the neighborhoods of New York are actually willing to make, but they're not the ones who grab microphones, denounce the police, and get media attention?
That's correct. In terms of, there's no denying that the law-abiding residents of even some of the high-crime neighborhoods of the city are concerned about police behavior when dealing with the criminal elements or the violators in their community. And that's the challenge for the police, because sometimes, unfortunately, all too frequently, in the case of thousands of instances, the people were attempting to, if you will, interrupt their behavior, whether it's an admonition, a summons, and the rest, sometimes basically push back, fight back, resist. And that's what draws an escalating behavior on the part of the police. Police are empowered to use force to effect an arrest. They are empowered to use force to protect themselves or the public. And a significant part of what we're seeing currently is increasingly, appears over the last several months, a number of individuals just failing to understand that you must submit to an arrest, that you cannot resist it, that the place to argue your case is in court, not in the middle of a street in a neighborhood somewhere.
Given the Garner death and the shooting of Mike Brown in St. Louis, there's a national moment of silence being scheduled for this Thursday, and these things seem to go on. These incidents take place that cause community backlash over and over again in city after city after city.
You will always have them. They will never go away. That's the nature of our lives, unfortunately. The idea is how you deal with them, how you try to prevent more of them from happening. But the reality is is that the nature of our society is that these events will occur. It's unfortunate that when they do occur, that in some instances they lead to violence, as they did in St. Louis, that because they, each of them is a opportunity to show that the systems that are in place, if allowed to proceed in their course, that oftentimes they will deal with the issues of concern, that you cannot have a rule of law that's influenced by demonstrations, et cetera. We have procedures in place to do investigations, grand juries, et cetera, countless court review. So the idea is that we will have these incidents, and the issue is to ensure that, to the best of our ability, that what happens is as transparent as it can be and that it conforms to the law. Something that needs to have as much attention paid to it as is paid to these incidents, the relatively rare occasions when the death occurs at the hands of the police, is the tens of thousands of young men and women in this country being killed during acts of violence. And it's my own belief that we need more attention focused on that. We now have two, maybe three generations of young men and women in this country that primarily and unfortunately in minority communities that are killing each other at a fast and furious pace. And we, the police, we're working very hard to deter that. But we are not the ultimate resolution of that issue, much the same as police-involved shootings, that the police are not the sole resolvers of those incidents. Going to take a coordinated effort on the part of public leaders, family leaders, religious leaders, police, community, to deal with something that's even more impactful, that, you know, the police taking of lives, it's unfortunate, but the numbers of young lives lost to police actions pale in comparison to the tens of thousands of lives that are lost every year to violence in America.
Police Commissioner Bratton, our guest on WNYC. And you get it from both sides, because the right says shootings are up in the city, as you acknowledge they are, because stop and frisk, which was to get guns off the street, has been discontinued. Could there be a connection?
Well, just that use of the term discontinued, and that's part of the misunderstanding of what has happened here. Stop, question, and frisk is the basic tool of American policing. Quality of life enforcement, usually in response to citizen concerns through 911 and 311 calls, is a basic element of American policing. Stop, question, and frisk has not gone away. It has not been discontinued. It has not been eliminated. Unfortunately, there are those in the city who, because of the misinterpretation of what's happened by political pundits and media, have this sense that it's over. I'm sorry, it's not over. That's it's been around as long as policing exists and will be around for as long as policing exists. And the idea is that you do it legally, lawfully, that you have to have reasonable suspicion. So that you know, you're right when you indicate that we are in the middle. We have those on the right wanting us to do one thing. We have those on the left wanting us to do another thing or not do another thing. And that's the challenge of policing, to conform to the law, to do the right thing in the right place at the right time.
Have the numbers of guns seized gone down since the practice was reformed?
They have, as has crime in the city continue to go down.
But not shootings.
Shootings are the only category of crime that has increased, and at the same time, shootings this year are the second lowest level in history in this city. So this running around as if the sky is falling, let's get real. This is an incredibly safe city. We've had an uptick in shooting because we've got a number of young men out there who refuse to understand that they just cannot go out and shoot somebody because they don't like the way they look or they live in a different building than them.
But an uptick in crime, in shootings, at the same time that you say fewer guns are being taken off the street as a result of stop-and-frisk reforms, no connection?
I'm sorry. We don't know if there's that connection at all, and I don't think we ever will know that connectivity, because other levels of activity have increased, other levels of activity have decreased. This is still a very safe city. Homicides are down almost 15% this year. Overall crime is down over 4%. Robberies, the bellwether crime of street violence, is down the lowest level it's been in almost 20 years. So the focus on shootings is appropriate. We spend a lot of time on it because we're losing young lives to significant injuries. But the resolution of that issue is not just in the hands of the police, in the hands of the DAs and the courts, and most importantly, it's in the hands of community, in terms of communities whose kids are killing other kids in those communities. And so we need help in those communities to address this issue, to give us information who has guns so we can get the guns before they are used to shoot and kill and maim. So no, in the sense of the focus on shootings is appropriate, but you put it into proportion, if you will. This year, even with the number of shootings, last year was the only year in the history of the city that shootings were lower than
this year.
So it's, you need to keep things in proportionality.
The Times piece on Kelling recalls that the 1982 article that first laid out broken windows acknowledged that the model first used in Newark, of all places, in the 1970s, had made neighborhoods more orderly but not reduced recorded crime. So is there, in the intervening years, good science, in your opinion, that it has reduced violent crime in a real cause and effect way?
I base my judgment on my own experience that academics have their theories, they have their science. I, as a practitioner, base my, if you will, judgment on what I've experienced. I was living broken windows before George Kelling and Jim Wilson wrote about it in 82. I was living it in the 70s in Boston, and I clearly saw the idea of putting police officers into a neighborhood dedicated to that neighborhood would have a dramatic effect. It did. So in my formulative years as a young sergeant lieutenant in Boston running a neighborhood policing program that ultimately became called community policing, I saw firsthand the wisdom and the benefit of it. But it is always essential to the idea that it has to be problem-solving. In other words, what is causing fear and concern in a neighborhood? Focus on that. At the same time, focus on relationship building. So where we're going in the NYPD now, for example, is as we start graduating new classes going into the future, those officers will be assigned to precincts to work with training officers so they get a better experience. And instead of just being sent into neighborhoods to look for stop, question, frisk types of behavior, to go into those neighborhoods to learn about the neighborhoods, to work with the community, to work with mentoring members of the community, work with mentoring officers. We are making an effort to continue very effective policing, but also effective community relation building at the same time.
Before you go, if I could ask you about the prospect of Brooklyn getting the Democratic convention, which I know you addressed yesterday. What would you do differently from the Bloomberg-Kelly force in 2004 when it was widely perceived that they did a kind of preventive detention sweep of the streets and then got pretty embarrassed in court by so many arrests being discredited?
What we will do going forward is what we always try to do, learn from the past, what worked, what didn't work, what was deemed to be appropriate, what was deemed to be inappropriate. So as we've come out of that period of time, as I've come out of many similar types of issues that I've been exposed to in my career, both experiencing personally, watching my colleagues deal with, you always attempt to learn. Policing is an evolving continuum. It's always changing, always adapting. That's its great strength. So going forward into any major events we handle here, UN coming up, the United Nations annual coming together, which usually results in demonstrations.
And a big global warming protest, a big one, right?
That's correct. And then we have, again, the potential of the Democratic National Convention with all the resultant rallies and demonstrations and crowd management issues.
So can
you try to learn from the past to shape your strategies for the future.
Can you be specific at all about how you would accommodate lawful demonstrations differently at a Democratic convention?
No, I cannot be. That we will accommodate them lawfully. That and that, you know, basically that's the commitment that we have going forward.
Can I throw in a history question to ask you to look back to your first time here and what you see in retrospect as the mechanism that worked to reduce serious crime when you were Mayor Dinkins' transit police chief and then Mayor Giuliani's NYPD commissioner, as specifically as you can? Was it cracking down on certain small crimes at that time?
It was a combination of focus on quality of life crime that had been ignored totally in this city for a wide variety of reasons. In the 70s and 80s, there was no quality of life policing of any significant proportion in New York. The 6,000 subway cars totally covered with graffiti, the vast majority of turnstile arrays vandalized day in and day out, were a clear example of that. So that was one mistake in the 70s and 80s. Two was the size of the police force. It was reduced dramatically in the late 70s as a result of the budget issues, and it really wasn't until David Dinkins started hiring cops back in the 90s that the department grew to a size that was appropriate for its problems. And then thirdly, the CompStat revolution, the idea of understanding the need to hold police accountable for crime, because in the 70s and 80s it was felt that society was going to have to address the causes of crime, or what were thought to be the causes of crime, racism, poverty, the economy, demographics. Those weren't causes. They were influences. Cause of crime is people who decide to commit crime or in an emotional moment commit a crime. So police got better at doing two things at the same time. Focus on quality of life to deter crime, and focus on being able to respond to and solve crimes that did occur much more quickly. And then thirdly, in this city, there were enough cops. The city hired a lot of police, and it helped to provide a tipping point. So those are all lessons learned. And so what's different now in 2014 than it was in 1994 is the city was in the midst of a crime and fear and disorder crises in the 1990s. We are not in the midst of a crime and fear and disorder crises now, which actually gives us more time to focus on the building of community relations, the building of community confidence, and focus on training of our officers to meet the changing needs of the 21st century, particularly technology.
Police Commissioner William Bratton, thank you very much.
Pleasure talking to you. All the best.
It's our family meeting on punishment on the Brian Lehrer Show today, in the home, in the courts, and right now within the prison walls. Let's talk to two people who have been incarcerated, who now talk very openly and forcefully about that experience. Glenn Martin spent 6 years in New York State Prison. He's a founder of the Fortune Society, which fights for criminal justice reform, and now head of his group, Just Leadership USA. And Piper Kerman spent a year in women's prison on felony money laundering conviction. She wrote the book Orange is the New Black about that experience. And, of course, there's the Netflix show of the same name. She has also become a strong advocate for prison reform herself. Glenn and Piper, welcome back to WNYC. Thank you very much for coming on today.
Thank you. Glad to be
Hello.
Back.
Hello. Thanks.
And Piper, I understand from your vacation cabin, so thank you for taking the time.
Someone else's vacation cabin, but I'm happy to be here.
And Glenn, in our office, when we talked about doing a segment like this, we were referring it to it as with quote-unquote ex-cons. And then we were wondering about the language of that and defining someone, especially someone who's out. by that label. Do you have a preferred language when referring to someone who's been in prison? Because that term still gets bandied about easily.
Sure. I think any sort of language that rehumanizes the folks that we're talking about works for me. Using the language of the system to describe people in the system, convict, prisoner, ex-con, and so on, really just serves to dehumanize folks. Department of Corrections tends to use this language to be able to other the people who are serving time so that there's a huge distinction between the human beings that are there to do their job and so on, and the inmates, convict, ex-offenders, and so on. It's a lot easier to put an inmate in a cell for 23 hours a day than it is to put a person.
And can you talk a little bit about your personal experience, what you were sent to jail for or prison, if you're comfortable with that today? And did it feel like it was about making you learn a lesson to change you for the future, to make you less likely to be a repeat offender, or simply to remove you from society, to protect other people from you at the current moment, or, you know, something even lower than that, like somebody was getting their grins?
So I went to prison about 20 years ago, and my initial offer was 20 to 40. So the first thing I want to say is that the first time I even had a sense of what sort of time I was facing was well beyond having the handcuffs on. So the idea of deterrence, I'm not really sure about that component of the criminal justice system, because two things. One, people who are out there committing crime don't tend to follow legislative statutes as they change from year to year. Two, most people who commit crime have no intentions of getting caught, so they're not thinking about deterrent effect. But I went to prison, and, you know, the first thing I noticed was that mass incarceration is like the biggest joke on the American public, because while I was there for a robbery where no one was physically hurt but still defined as a violent crime according to New York State statutes, the biggest joke about mass incarceration is that there were so many people there for much less serious offenses for four, five, six times the amount of time I was serving.
But that's mass incarceration. That's a social analysis. What about you? Did it deter you from doing it again because you did not want to go back to that place?
Yeah, you know, what deterred me from committing crime again was access to education. I happened to have the opportunity to earn a 2-year liberal arts degree while I was in prison. And it was the experience of being able to essentially travel more in prison than I ever did growing up in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, that changed my outlook on the world and where I fit into it. And probably more importantly, allowed me to humanize people who didn't look like me, who didn't come from the same socioeconomic status as me. So it's hard to transgress against other folks when you have a better sense of how you fit into the fabric of society, how you fit into the American dream. And the fact that other people have the same feelings and the same sort of aspirations and hopes and goals as you do.
Piper, people who've read Orange is the New Black know something of your experience or seen the show and that version of it. But, you know, and they would know that it's a very different experience from Glenn's in so many ways. But are there similarities, having heard his story, in which you would enter?
I mean, Glenn's story is so compelling and just offers such a clear picture of what doesn't work with incarceration and the sliver of hope that education in prison can provide. In my case, you know, I was sent to prison for a nonviolent drug offense, a first-time drug offense. And oddly, in my case, I was sent to prison for a drug offense that I had committed many, many, many years in the past. So in 2004, when I walked through federal prison gates to begin serving a mercifully short sentence, more than a decade had passed since I had committed that offense, and I was not committing crimes in the interim. So no one can claim that my prison sentence prevented new crimes. It was certainly punitive. There's no question about that. And there is no question that I broke the law knowingly. But I joined a huge percentage of both our federal and our state prison systems, which is nonviolent low-level drug offenders. And so I think one of the questions that everyone who's listening has to ask themselves is, what do we expect to accomplish from those sentences for those folks specifically? If what we expect from our drug laws is that they will lower access to illegal drugs, that they will lower substance abuse and lower addiction, those laws are a flagrant failure, because basically the war on drugs and the policies around them got put in place about 30 years ago. And today, drugs are cheaper, they are easier to get, and they are more potent than they were when this sort of failed experiment was begun. So, you know, in terms of punishment and whether the punishment gets the result that we want, there are many areas in our criminal justice system where we have clearly very bad laws on the books.
So, listeners, in your experience, what is prison for in theory and in real life? Who listening now has been to prison? And did it serve the purpose for you? Many of our listeners would hope that it would. 212-433-WNYC. Did it make you less likely rather than more likely to commit more crime when you got out? 212-433-9692. And how much did the idea of punishment play into your prison experience? 212-433-9692 for Glenn Martin and Piper Kerman. And Glenn, assuming you accept prison as a legitimate institution at all, if done right, are there positive models that you would cite?
Well, you know, I have an older brother who's actually a federal correction officer for many years, and I've learned a lot from him about how he thinks about his job as someone who works within the system. And actually, when I look at the federal system, I mean, I'm not holding it out as any model. There are definitely better models in other countries that we can look at, although the United States doesn't tend to care much about what other countries are doing on this issue. But at least on the federal system, there's a level of respect between the officers and the people doing time and their families that I think lends itself to a more positive, more rehabilitative experience. There's more programming on the federal level, nowhere near enough. But if you look at the state system, the entire system is built on punishment. I mean, you can be walking on a walkway in a prison, in a state prison here in New York, and an officer is having a bad day, and you look at him or her the wrong way, and if they say, we'll see you later in the housing block, you can guarantee at some point later there's going to be six or seven officers showing up, and there'll probably be a razor blade suddenly in your plant, and you'll probably be on your way to the box for weeks, if not months. And so, you know, I think there's a huge question about the legitimacy of a system that's inherently built on this pursuit of punishment, and whether or not the people who are serving time are learning any lessons about their own need to turn around and rehabilitate themselves if they're being overseen by correction officers that don't have legitimacy themselves. I remember serving on the Inmate Liaison Committee, which is a committee that engages the administration around, you know, basic needs, right? You know, towels and toilet paper and those sort of things. And I remember stacking the deck by bringing on six or seven college graduates to serve on that committee, and the administration was pissed off. And here I am walking down the walkway, and suddenly we're all in a box within hours. Within hours, we're all in SHU. And the question to me 2 weeks later was, do you want to stay here in the box, or do you want to get out of here, stop causing trouble, get off the committee, and go home?
And when you talk about the corrections officers and how people are treated, of course, there's been a lot of reporting about that just recently at Rikers. There was that big story in the Times about how mentally disabled inmates are treated. Then the U.S. attorney said he was looking into how young inmates with mental illness are being abused. And I want to replay a caller to this show from last week that is so relevant to this conversation, because we actually got an anonymous call from someone at Rikers. I guess you can listen to the radio at Rikers Island and use a phone sometimes, talking about those abuses, but also getting at some of the larger questions of punishment. So here's about a minute of that call for everyone to hear. And just for context, he refers to the FOR building, which is the youth facility, mm-hmm. and to COs, which stands for corrections officers or guards. Take a listen.
I was in the FOR building, which is the building that houses the teenagers. It's half teenagers and half adults. They're just now trying to change that and make it all teenagers and then people over 50. But the problem is that the COs, you know, they're not trained, I mean, as everyone has said, and the kids can get unruly, and it's peer pressure. And what I will say is that the COs are very good about not keeping the kids separate from the adults, because they always say, you know, one of these kids could turn around and just stab you. You know, they're kids, and they're in a box, and where they're put is terrible, and they're constantly screamed at all day long. You know, it's negative energy in these kids' heads all day long, screaming, 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 you're bad, you're bad, you're bad. So eventually, they just believe they're bad, and then they just act out.
One of the callers to our show last week, calling anonymously from Rikers. Piper Kerman, want to react to that, particularly the idea of that cycle of you're bad, and then they act out.
Yeah. I think that one of the fundamentals of the experience of incarceration for any person is the struggle to hold on to some sense of humanity for yourself, and that's true whether you are held in truly appalling conditions like the ones on Rikers Island and in many city and county jails. Often those conditions are the worst conditions. Or if you're lucky enough to be in a minimum security federal prison camp. I mean, if you want to call that luck. Still, you have to hang on to humanity, because everything the system is telling you generally is that you are the worst, that you are your worst action, you are your worst choice. And so a huge part of that experience of incarceration is trying to remind yourself one way or another that you are not simply your biggest mistake, your worst choice, your least moral choice, but you are more than that. You are a more complex person. You are capable of good. You are capable of positive contribution. There's nothing about the correctional system, any correctional system that I've been in contact with, that really accomplishes that, and hence the sort of failure of rehabilitation for our prison system and the two-thirds failure rate that the prison system generally gets. Two-thirds of people who go through prison and jail will likely return to prison or jail, and so that's pretty unacceptable.
And I wonder if that limiting of the definition of somebody's humanity informed your concept for Orange is the New Black, because I think one of the things that certainly the television show does is show sort of the full range of human emotion among prisoners, even comedy.
That was absolutely my goal in writing the book, in the choice of sort of talking about my own experience and how my own life intersected with other women's lives and experiences, which were sometimes very different than mine. To make that point, because that is literally how you survive a prison sentence, is your sense of connectivity to other people. And the most important thing about those connections are the positive connections, the ways in which you can contribute and ways in which you can sort of help each other. I'll make a point about the construct of a prison sentence. You know, basically, an individual transgresses, they break the law, they do something that, you know, the community doesn't like. And the choice of a prison sentence is to marginalize that person by saying, we're going to take you out of the community, we're going to put you to the side, we're going to push you to the margins, essentially, as your punishment. And then at some point, your punishment will be over, and that marginalization, in theory, will be done, though that's generally not the case. I feel like, especially for a huge swath of the population which does not commit horrific violent crimes, you know, that construct of the prison sentence takes you out of the community that you've harmed and distances the individual from the harm they may have caused. And so when you're in prison, it's all about the struggle to survive prison as opposed to a meditation on the harm you may have caused to the community. And that's a real flaw in the construct of incarcerating so many people for reasons other than pure public safety.
But then the perpetrator, especially if it's a violent perpetrator, does at least get removed from the victim, and the victim doesn't have to fear the perpetrator again, or the society fear the perpetrator again in the community.
Mm-hmm. That is absolutely true, and I think concerns about true public safety and violence are very valid concerns, but you have to look at half of the federal prison system and huge percentages of state systems, which are not filled with those kinds of people who have committed those kinds of crimes,
and that's the
but
point.
Rather much more low-level offenses. And so you have to question, what is the social reason that we've chosen to do that?
Let's take a few phone calls. A lot of people are calling in with their prison experiences and whether they thought they were effective for their lives and for society. And Mike in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. Thank you.
Great. I just wanted to make a comment. You have to judge these things by the individual. Perfect example, mother and father, professional. I grew up in Newark, never had a problem, passed 3 police tests and a county police test. However, I was being bullied, and this went on for years, maybe 2 years, 2.5 years. And I was with my girlfriend. I was 20 years old at the time, and I was being bullied. And so I got into a fight, and then I picked up a pipe, and I beat this guy till he was almost near death. Make a long story short, even though that was my first time getting arrested and or locked up, I had a 5-year sentence. I did 3 years out of that. But then when I came out of prison, I didn't fear anything. Once you go to prison and you can survive prison without going on drugs or anything, you go out, you come out with a different mindset. You know you have a criminal record. You don't care anymore. You know your future's down the tubes. So you have to judge everything by the individual. I've gone to private school my whole life, never had a problem. But that one incident, you know, messed my whole life up.
Mike, was your future down the tubes, or did your prison experience and what you just described about becoming stronger actually help you to turn it around?
Well, actually, I'm still a good guy, but once you come out of prison and you figure you can take the abuse of the guards or the fighting that's in there, and you come back out into society, not stating that you'll be a bad person, but you'll take whatever comes your way. Even if something happens again, you have to go to prison again, you know you can take it. I mean, take me. I was a good, decent guy, and I had nothing to lose anymore, you know?
Yeah. Mike, thank you very much. And Glenn, to that point, people might point to you and say that you're a prime example of the fact that it is possible to be rehabilitated after you leave prison and through prison. You talked about some education you got there, yeah, and you got your life on track. So why can't people take you as a positive model of why prison can work?
So people often point to me as the exception to the rule, in fact, and what I often say to people is, no, I was exposed to exceptional opportunities. So access to Pell Grants was taken away 20 years ago by Congress being tough on crime, and most college programs disappeared then.
And Governor Cuomo tried to get some reinstituted in New York State, and he couldn't get it through the legislature this year.
That is true. Some of our conservative upstate Republicans decided that the research and the data didn't matter, and that what mattered was who's deserving and who's non-deserving. But I would argue that every time a legislator is tough on crime without looking at the data and the research, they're actually being pretty soft on crime, because the truth is people who exit prison and have no place to go and nothing to do often end up recidivating. I want to go back for 1 second to Rikers Island. I'm thinking of people that might be on Rikers Island listening to this. I was on Rikers Island 20 years ago in C-74 when I had the honor of being invited to the inauguration of our current mayor. And when everyone was standing there to take a picture of him, I said, "Mr. Mayor, with all due respect, I can take a picture with you anytime over the next few years. I want to say to you, you should close down Rikers Island." And he said to me, "Why?" And I said, "Because nothing good can come from this place." And Rikers Island has not changed in the last 20 years. I'm sure it goes back even further, but I feel such a responsibility to say out loud on this radio show that those young men and young women there are sitting there idle and being abused every single day, and it hasn't changed for over 20 years.
If you close the physical facility, what do you do with the people who are arrested while they're awaiting trial?
You decentralize the jail. You put people back in the boroughs where they come from. You give them access to support services, their lawyers, and so on. Right now, the majority of people there are detainees. Let's not forget that. 13,000, the majority detainees, over 80%. And many people there for $1,000 or $2,000 bail. And lastly, 40% of the people on Rikers Island today have a mental health diagnosis.
Mike in Toms River, you're on WNYC. Hello, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
All right. You got a story.
So I want to say, as far as jail and the deterrent, I'm a white 60-year-old male. And about 6 years ago, I had a DUI, and I spent 13 days in the county jail.
You did. As a 54-year-old white guy, you got 13 days in the slammer for a DUI?
Yes. And basically, my point is,
you must have been really drunk.
I spent those 13 days in jail, and I'll tell you what, I have never had a sip of alcohol and been behind a wheel since. That was my deterrent right there, because when you go to jail for the first time, you realize you can't get a bottle of water whenever you want. You can't go get a cheeseburger. And all those simple things you take for granted are taken away. And I'll tell you what, I would never drink and drive again for anything in the world for taking the chance and going back there. And it was only a county jail. I wasn't anything like Rikers or a state penitentiary.
The deterrent effect worked on Mike and Tom's River. And Brian in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good morning, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
I'm calling in because I was asked to, you know, you have experience, you can call in. I want to share that I spent about 12 years in federal prison on a 13-and-a-half-year sentence. And when I came home in 2007, I had pledged to myself not to go back. Not that I think that prison itself, I needed 12 years to be deterred from prison, but because of the overall experience and what I saw in there. It is my belief that people can be deterred, especially with the federal drug law being so harsh. I don't want to repeat it is draconian, as you hear everyone say. But I believe that the federal drug law is way too harsh, and this mass incarceration of people, you know, it didn't take, and believe I left a lot of good guys behind there with life sentences and some ridiculous sentences for a whole lot of minor stuff. I think the laws need to be individualized, and judges need to judge people individually and not on a mass scale as they're doing it. So again, my
and for you, when you got out after 12 years, did you feel prison taught you a lesson? Maybe that's too pat a cliche, or helped you figure out how to go straight, or just not wanting to go back there again?
Well, you know, I think I was on the straight path. I just deviated a little. But my getting out of prison, I've made a pledge to walk around my community and to be a support in my community to the young guys who don't get it. I was trying to use my experience to try to mentor kids in the community and make sure that they don't have the experience I experienced. Not because I think prison is a very bad place. My experience in prison, I met people who are really, I think, without a prison institution, I don't know what we would do with them in society. But I think that the time that they're giving out is just way too much to get people's attention and to focus them. I think what your guest is saying, community programs, a lot of these people, young guys, who was wasting their time in prison, they could be grabbed by members in the community and shaken up and be a more productive citizen right. than sitting down in prison wasting your time.
Brian, thank you very much, and good luck to you. And so, Piper Kerman, to finish up, I think we keep gravitating back toward this idea that, you know, pretty much everyone agrees with at this point, that too many people are going to prison for too many low-level, nonviolent offenses. Mm-hmm. But could you finish up on, having been there, having now studied it, done, you know, both research on it and pop culture about it, if you think there's something that makes prison good for people who do have to go to prison, some of the more violent offenders perhaps, or what makes prison as good as it could be when it is necessary?
I have a friend named Joe Loya, and Joe wrote a great memoir called The Man Who Outgrew His Prison Cell. He did, I think, about 7 years of Fed time and several years of state time, so he probably spent about a decade behind bars for robbing banks. He robbed about 21 banks. And he transformed his life while he was incarcerated. He spent more than 2 years in the SHU in solitary confinement, and writing saved his life. And Joe and I were talking about this very subject, and he said, you know, because he has a lot more experience than I do with folks who are incarcerated for crimes of violence, he said, look, there are some people who just don't play well with others. And that's what we may potentially need prisons and jails for, is, you know, potentially to, you know, provide for true public safety when it comes to violence, and to rehabilitate people who need a lot of help to truly succeed and be integrated into the community. What we don't want is to have fortresses where we lock up human beings for their entire lives, because it's fruitless, it's inhumane. And we know from looking outside of the United States, which happens too rarely, that there are better ways to do it.
And just to finish,
I visited exactly one prison, which is a medium security men's prison in the Midwest, which has really remarkable rehabilitation programs. And a lot of those guys are there for very serious felonies, including crimes of violence. And they treat those guys with a sense of dignity, which is very different from anything I've seen in any prison, men's or women's prison. And those opportunities include work. They include sort of cognitive behavior therapy around substance abuse, mental illness, and also the experience of violence, which is true for many of these men when you talk to them about their personal, their lives, their histories, their backgrounds. And they just create a sense of community in that prison, which is unlike anything I've ever seen. And that's the thing that everyone needs to understand about a prison or a jail, is that, like it or not, it is its own community behind bars. And it's a community sort of defined by hardship and scarcity, but there are human beings striving to, you know, embody their full humanness as they do their time.
Piper Kerman wrote Orange is the New Black. Glenn Martin is the head of Just Leadership USA. Thank you both so very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now your calls on the life of Robin Williams for the rest of our time today. We'll play a few clips from Williams' long career, including some that aren't getting that much play elsewhere, we think. Though, of course, any attempt to capture the range of his work in just a few clips will inevitably fall short. But we'll take calls from anyone as first priority who had a personal connection to Robin Williams, just to remember him and his work and what he was like, if you knew him or worked with him. We're going to give priority to anyone who knew him, like we did when Lou Reed died, because we know so many of you in our audience in that field did work with him, in this case, in movies and comedy. 212-433-9692. With so many actors and comedians and filmmakers in New York, I'm sure there are people listening right now who did cross paths with Robin Williams. What are you not seeing in the many tributes and obituaries that you may want to share with your fellow listeners, a personal account or a story, a sense of him that you were able to get one-on-one or in your working group? 212-433-9692. And as your calls are coming in, the first clip we'll play is from one of the earliest appearances that he's known for. This is Robin Williams on The Tonight Show, really making America take notice, chatting with Johnny Carson, October 14th, 1981.
People always think reformers don't get nervous.
Not at all, really. I don't. Oh, God. Not really. Not at all. Not really. Not me. No way.
Is there some reason you don't do? Is it the fact that you get nervous?
Very much
many
so.
Shows?
I suffer from severe dyslexia, too. Oh. I was the only child in my block on Halloween to go trick or trout. People go, oh, look, here comes that young Williams boy again. Better get some fish. Here you go. Say hi to your mom and dad. Hope they find you.
Oh. Where is home for you? Or did you come from a home?
They said all the people in the institution, Tommy. If you haven't taken your medication yet, it's going to be fine.
They're back at 12.
Back at 12, yeah. No. How are you, Mr. Williams? I'm real fine. I'm...
Look at this thing. Look, Flipper.
Right now, there's a sound man going, what are you doing? Oh, God. I better relax. It's okay. I'm on
TV.
It's
all right, just...
You're a nice man. You won't hurt me.
No.
Well, let me just one sip. Certainly. Okay, thank you. Don't be afraid. The sores went away.
The simplex two, is it? Yeah. Or one? One or
a
two?
A real man can stand up to herpes.
All right, Robin Williams on Johnny Carson, The Tonight Show, October 1981. And one of the visuals there, Williams was barking up into the boom mic, the mic that you never see on camera because it's above their heads, and drinking from Johnny Carson's cup. And, you know, Carson usually a pretty cool customer, is just trying to keep up. And that, of course, was part of Robin Williams' brilliance, but probably in the long run, part of his psychological challenge, the incredible energy that he brought to it. And how could he keep up with himself? They say that's one of the things that drove him to cocaine. How could he keep up with himself? How could he keep that level of energy that the public was coming to depend on him for? Anyway, if you knew Robin Williams, you're going to get first priority on the phone, 212-433-WNYC. If you ever met him, worked with him on a set in a comedy club, whatever, but anyone else may call as well, 212-433-WNYC, as we remember the late, great Robin Williams today, 212-433-9692. And here's Ellen in Nyack. Hi, Ellen, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks so much for taking my call. Yes. I was friends with a woman named Monica who was in the Rick and Ruby show in San Francisco, which was a kind of a jokey song duo, and she and her partner were friends with Robin Williams when he was just starting out, and he was very, very generous to them. He had them perform at a lot of his stand-up gigs, and when she got married in the early 80s, I went to her wedding, and he was a guest there, and he was just getting started. It was probably 1981 or 1982, so he was just getting well-known, but I did know of him, and what so impressed me at this this wedding was that by the punch bowl where they were serving the food, there were a lot of elderly ladies who were the servers, and he was just standing there cracking them up. Mm-hmm. He was doing one joke after another, and they were laughing so hard they could hardly serve the food.
So he was, and Ellen, I'm going to leave it there, but it's a great story of how he was kind of in a public place with regular people. Zach in West Palm Beach. You're on WNYC. Hi, Zach.
Yeah, hi, Brian. Thank you. I first met Robin in 1983 at a Sabret hot dog stand on 54th and Broadway. He noticed my tenor saxophone case, and he said, "Sax, cool." And then a year later, when I saw the film, I realized that he had been in makeup and costume and on location making Moscow on the Hudson. At the time, I was doing a solo show with a rack of electronics and gave him a flyer and asked if he would come. He took the flyer and he said, send one to his manager on 57th Street. So I did. He didn't come. But fast forward to 1993. I'm in San Francisco. I'm the general manager of Music Annex Studios, and I make the deal with the L.A. Film Studio to produce the audio dailies for Mrs. Doubtfire, audio daily transfers. Robin did all his ADR dialogue recording at another studio in San Francisco, Russian Hill Recording. But he came by over to Music Annex once. I took him upstairs to our empty top floor and blew him a few notes on my saxophone. He told me he wished he could play the saxophone like me. Mm. I mean, that was so nice.
Nice,
you know?
Nice story, Zach. And I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Let's play a couple more clips. Two of Robin Williams that sort of helped to tell the background story to one of his most famous comedy specials. Here he is in 2006. On Fresh Air, talking to Terry Gross about his early career and how he came to walk that line between stand-up comedy and wild improvisation. Take a listen.
First time I did a paying gig was at a club in Orange County called the Laugh Stop, and the whole sound system blew out. And so all of a sudden they said, "Go on." I went up there, and because I didn't need a mic to begin with, I just worked the crowd and kind of till they got the sound system back up. And it really kind of helped build a style that was more like use anything, anywhere, and with the improv background, if anyone said anything, to go off on it. Like one time in a New York club, some woman yelled out, "Dr. Roof." She was trying to say Dr. Ruth, but she'd had five gin and tonics. And I started doing Dr. Roof, who was like a black sex therapist. Mm-hmm. And you could start, mm-hmm. Man say foreplay, mm-hmm. You not done, mm-mm. You know, protection, mm-mm. Get away from me, that's my protection. Straight edge razor, mm-hmm. But it was all part of, you know, building a style that was pretty loose. And then later on, you would start to put structure to it. By the time I did Night at the Met, it was pretty, it started to have like a flow and kind of a structure. But up till then, it was pretty freeform.
So Robin Williams from Fresh Air in 2006. At the end there, he mentioned Live at the Met, that special, and balancing scripted jokes with freeform riffs. Well, here's Williams from Live at the Met. And listen for the way he flows in and out of improvisation, whipping the audience back and forth, and, of course, how openly here he talks about his addictions.
You know what I'm talking about? The Peruvian marching powder, the devil's dandruff. It's a nice thing, though. Cocaine. Mmm, what a wonderful drug. Anything that makes you paranoid and impotent, give me more of that. Mmm, what a fake thing to do. Whoop, we're back with sound again. Sorry about the sound. I got the sound from Hollywood. People in the balcony were going, "We understood him. I guess Juilliard helped for a brief moment. I could enunciate to the back row, just like Sylvester Stallone doing Hamlet. This would be a place where Stallone could do Hamlet. To be or what?" Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Jeez. We're back again. We were discussing cocaine for a brief moment. Sound crapped up, but that's why I'm using Sapaza sound. No one wants their tapes back. I wonder why. We're talking about how cocaine basically affects you. There's also something called freebasing. It's not free. It costs you your house. It should be called home basing.
Robin Williams from back then. By the way, the Fresh Air interview that we excerpted from, we just found out Terry Gross and company will be re-airing that, I guess, in full this afternoon on Fresh Air. So I'm sure many of you Robin Williams fans will want to hear that. As we take your calls right now with your recollections of Robin Williams, if you worked with him at all or knew him personally at all, as well as anyone else, 212-433-WNYC. Kim in Brooklyn. Hi, Kim. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I have a memory from about 25 years ago when I was working at Books & Company. The books are on the Upper East Side. And I went in one early Sunday morning to open it with the manager. There were just the two of us there. The store hadn't opened yet. And it was very sleepy on Madison Avenue at 10 o'clock. And the gates weren't up, and we heard the gates rattling. And we looked out, and there's some guy trying to get in. And we started to say, "We're not open yet." And then we realized, holy, is that Robin Williams? Well, of course we'll let him in. So we let him in. It was just the two of us and him, and he wandered around. He might have bought a book, maybe not, I don't remember. But when he came to the register, he launched into one of his riffs, and it was just the two of us. And it went on for 10 or 15 minutes. I remember it involved a corn cob that was on the cover of one of the books on the counter. It involved my earrings. And the register was in there as well because it was an old-fashioned register. It was 25 years ago. I don't remember any more of the details, but it was extraordinary. And this other fellow and I just stood there with our jaws dropped.
It sounds like an extraordinary moment. By going into an improv riff like that, do you think he was trying to connect with you or not have to connect with you because he was performing?
Both. I mean, our essential feeling was how exhausting it must be to be this man.
Yeah.
I mean, it was hilarious, but it was strange and bizarre. Yeah. And what, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe he was anxious just being alone with two people.
Yeah.
It was impossible for us to know.
Star.
And then there, you know, there,
Kim, that's
with
a great...
no further ado, he just walked out of the store.
Thank you very much for that memory. And by the way, we're kind of agreeing to the request of his family, which is to focus, at least in this first pass of conversation on this show, on his the joy that he brought to people. Maybe later in the week we'll do something on, you know, the issues of depression and suicide as the death of Robin Williams raises. But right now we're just remembering him as a person and an actor and a comedian. And Nicholas in Highland, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nicholas.
Hey, how you doing? So throughout the 80s, as you may remember, the comedy club thing just got real big in New York. I'm a cameraman, cinematographer, lighting designer. So here I am, this young guy. I'm 30 years old. I got a camera on my shoulder. I'm sitting on the front lip of a stage, I guess at the Laugh Factory maybe. And he's on stage, and he is just going wild. I cannot hold a shot. I can't. I'm roaring. So he rescues me. He comes over and makes me a part of his bit. Comes, sits down next to me, starts directing. Fast forward 3 years. With Alan King interviewing Robin Williams as a part of a show he did called Inside the Comedy Mind. I'm a lighting designer. I'm sitting in the studio. We were laughing in the control room. We were laughing so hard that the sound came through the glass and spoiled the track. But the sound man couldn't tell because he was laughing so hard.
We just have 30 seconds left, but, you know, I saw the film critic, David Edelstein, on TV last night say movies failed mostly to capture his improvisatory, freewheeling self. And I guess you're talking about that a little bit, how tough it was technically even for a cameraman when Robin was being Robin.
Unbelievable. So to cap it off, he was living on the Upper West Side at the time, which I was. I get out of a cab on 74th Street,
5 seconds.
Walking down the street, and there he is, and he goes, "You again?"
Thank you for your call. Thank you all for your calls. And we'll end with a clip of Robin Williams that we honestly had a bit of hesitation about playing because it's just being played everywhere. And it does take on a particularly maudlin tone coming on the heels of his death. But it's a brilliant moment and powerful. And we'll let it stand on its own as the last word. Robin Williams quoting Whitman from Dead Poets Society.
Poetry, beauty, romance, love. These are what we stay alive for. To quote from Whitman, "O me, O life, of the questions of these recurring, of the endless trains of the faithless, of cities filled with the foolish, what good amid these, O me, O life? Answer, that you are here, that life exists and identity, that the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse. That the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse. What will your verse be?
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.